Welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is J Dog. This is a special episode on the legendary American Maverick, Melvin Van Peebles. We're going to be talking about his first two features, Watermelon Man and Story of a 30-Day Pass. And yes, a special guest and Melvin, I guess maybe super fan.
Sure, that works.
And making his first appearance on our second season, Martin Kessler.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. Anyway, yeah, you'll be back again next year for... Yeah, so this...
I think Clockers maybe, yeah. Yeah. Or something. I'll be back for something.
Yeah, I think it is Clockers. But anyway, yeah. Yeah, so I listened to your podcast. I guess Flick Wise Canada and Flick Wise are the same thing, kind of, sort of. But you didn't...
Yeah, it's all on the same feed, yeah.
Yeah, you did a Story of 30 Pass episode. And
That sounds about right, with Marcus Pinn as a guest.
Yeah, and that's when I realized, okay, you're the perfect person for a Melvin episode. So what's your history with Melvin?
Story of a 30-Day Pass was kind of my entry point. I kind of knew about Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song because it's referenced so much. And then kind of when I was getting into Melvin Van Peebles films, the Badass biopic by his son Mario came out. So like it all sort of happened at once. But 30-Day Pass is definitely my entry point. I think just as a blind, maybe at a dollar store, if that sounds right, on VHS. And later I bought the DVD thinking it would be an improvement, but it's like the exact same quality as the VHS tape. So I keep hoping that somebody's going to put it on Blu-ray. I think Vinegar Syndrome was going to under their Etiquette Pictures label for a little bit, and then I guess now Etiquette Pictures is defunct, so I'm not sure if they're going to release it or not. They released Sweetback on Blu-ray, but no luck for Story of Their Past yet. And like, it's sort of a shame because like it's such a good looking film, I think, but I was just completely blown away. And it's a film I kind of come back to every so often and find maybe some new meaning in, especially like as I have more life experience, I guess it's one of my favorite films.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, gradually kind of work my way through his filmography. I still remember another one of his films I don't think has ever had like a proper release, Confessions of an Ex-Doofus Itchy-Footed Mother. Did I get that right?
The title sounds vaguely familiar, but I have not seen that.
I might have butchered the title. It's possible. Like, I don't know, with Melvin Van Peebles' like music and writing, he always has these wonderful phrases that stick out in your mind, but it's sort of easy to botch. Like, you know, there's more syllables than the average movie title. But I saw that at a festival, maybe like my first year of university, and it, like, I've never seen it since. So I've seen a couple of his films that are a little bit harder to find, but you know, Story of a 30-Day Pass is the one I always kind of come back to.
So I presume you've seen Watermelon Man.
Of course. Yeah, I think like for me, Watermelon Man, it's it feels a little bit creaky in the way that a lot of like late 60s early 70s studio comedies kind of feel creaky, and it's sort of funny being sandwiched in between Story of a 30-Day Pass and Sweetback, seeing how kind of the studio system restrained Melvin Van Peebles' style. And there's still like little bursts of energy and bursts of creativity. And I think the only reason why that film is still watchable to this day is completely to his credit. He talked a little bit about how when the studio system kind of started courting him, I think it was a Paramount film,
Columbia.
Okay, thank you. Like, based off the success of Story of a 30-Day Pass, he kind of got invited into the studio system, and he had a 3-picture deal, and, you know, it's sort of funny that he kind of worked his way into a system that would never normally welcome him in, and then he tossed it away to go off and be an independent filmmaker. But, you know, this is sort of his one real studio effort, Watermelon Man. And it wasn't his story. It was a screenplay that was already written, and they were looking just to produce as, you know, as like a regular studio picture. And I think the original cast, they were looking to cast
Alan
like
Arkin.
either, Alan Arkin or Jack Lemmon as the lead. And what you'd realize is that, like, oh, like it would have been a blackface movie. It would have been like unwatchable today. This terrible disaster. And like I think, you know, Melvin Van Peebles is a very slick, smart guy. How he kind of pitched it to them as well, you know, he's only white for like the first 5, 10 pages of the script. You should cast a black actor and have him in whiteface for the first few scenes, have him in makeup to be white. And, you know, basically pitched it to them as being, you know, well, this would be easier, but that basically, I think, saved the film from being just like this unwatchable embarrassment. And Godfrey Cambridge, like,
He's
I don't know about
incredible.
you, but for me, my favorite parts of the film were actually like in those first scenes where he's in whiteface, because it's just like his parody of a, you know, this like white repressed bigot, like, or not repressed, he's actually kind of a sleazebag, but like just not a likable guy at all. And like it's his, you know, caricature, like.
On the Cotton Comes Harlan episode, I made it clear, like, I love Godfrey Cambridge and feel like he didn't get the career he deserved because he kind of,
Well, he
unfortunately,
died so young. Like, I think I've seen him in like Cotton Comes to Harlem, of course, and I think he has like a small role in Freddie Foster, but aside from that, I have hardly seen him in things. And he died, like, you know, maybe not long after Cotton Comes to Harlem came out. I think he had like a heart attack or something, and
Yeah,
he
he has
was.
had a heart attack. Joel, what's your history with Melvin Van Peebles?
Well, I know the name, and I know Mario Van Peebles, and that's about it. No experience with the movies whatsoever. You know, I think you guys were talking about Sweet Sweetback and how it's we don't really need to talk about it because it's been talked to death, and that's basically the only association I would have had. I haven't seen that movie either. The two we watch for this are the only movies I've seen.
Okay, that's interesting, kind of coming at it like, you know, from the beginning of his career, because I think like for most people they see Sweetback first and then kind of circle around and try to find the other films as they get curious. But like it's such an interesting kind of career trajectory, I find, those first three, when you look at him basically making a French New Wave film as an American and then making a studio picture and then making an independent picture in America, that, you know, it's a heck of a career. Like, you know, everything about Melvin Van Peebles is sort of trailblazing.
That's
I,
pretty, yeah,
well,
that's pretty
like,
cool.
what were your initial impressions of his films?
I mean, Watermelon Man. Honestly, I wasn't digging that beginning part because I think it reminded me of people I actually knew. It was like, oh
Well,
man, irritating people like that.
oh, I
I do
have
like
a
that.
similar reaction. I have an ex-family member who my family member divorced him, who kind of reminds me of his that character.
It's such a like strong caricature that he does. Like, it immediately kind of sticks out in your mind. The voice he does, like, especially at the beginning when he's like first coming to the office, it makes me think of like, it makes me think a little bit of Divine in the John Waters films. Like, something about the like raspy, he does like a little bit of a higher voice for those scenes, and I just find it so funny. But like, I you know, and then later on, that's way before you have people like Eddie Murphy or Dave Chappelle kind of doing this like whiteface parody. But
And Godfrey, like, I think he quit stand-up at that point. He was like a big stand-up for like, I think, late 50s to like the late-ish 60s, and then he kind of became a recluse for a little bit. He like he wouldn't go out in public unless he had to work. I might be wrong, but that's from last time I read. And his career could have been really good, because like Watermelon Man came out on the same day as Cotton Comes to Harlem in like May something 1970, and so but then after that he kind of didn't do too much after that. There's Freddie Foster. He has a really funny scene with Yaphet Kotto, where
Right.
he's a gay guy and Yakuhodo doesn't want to shake his hand. It's offensive and messed up, but it's also like a really funny scene because like Godfrey, but he died on set of a TV movie where he was playing Idi Amin.
Oh,
wow!
That probably would. I don't know if it would have been like. I don't know if he was playing it seriously or comedically, but yeah. I have a feeling that would have been kind of hilarious because like Idi Amin was such a like. He's a monster, but it was also like so larger than life that like it's a really kind of I could see that being a great person to characterize if you're a comedian.
And there was a TV movie,
you know, the chest full of medals and stuff. Yeah,
so like who knows what it could have been, like a 70s TV movie.
Yeah, I don't like. Was it even a comedy or was it just
I
like a biopic?
If I remember correctly, it was not completed, and like. Right. And they're apparently like it was a curse of like any movie about Idi Amin, like something bad would happen and it wouldn't finish production.
Watch your back, Forrest Whitaker. Watch your back.
I think he would break the curse.
And well, like there's a couple other interesting actors in Watermelon Man 2. Like I noticed Derville Martin's in it
in a
small role. Like I think that's one of his first roles. And like he
I feel like his first role was Rosemary's Baby. He was the elevator
he's good,
man, I think.
Like a bit part, yeah. But like he sort of ends up becoming like Fred Williamson's sidekick for a bunch of films.
Yeah. And director of Dolomite.
Right, and director of Dolomite. Have you seen the previews for the Dolomite movie?
Yes, I have.
Not Dolomite, but the Rudy Ray Moore movie with Eddie Murphy.
Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy to see Wesley in something.
Right, it's good to see Wesley Snipes like not in a direct-to-video kind of movie. But well, actually, it might be going right to Netflix. I don't know, but I'm kind of excited to see that. I missed it when it was at TIFF. I kind of heard that like Eddie Murphy's not really playing Rudy Ray Moore. He's just kind of being Eddie Murphy, which like is a little disappointing. But I don't know. I need to see it for myself.
Yeah, the trailer makes it seem like he's like playing like a goofy idiot, but Rudy was a smart businessman who knew. Kind of like be like, because he was like a really like interesting like independent artist who made his own career, like even though like no one would give him a shot, and like in the trailers make it seem like oh he's just kind of a goofy idiot like Ed Wood. And it's like
yeah,
there's more to it, but whatever.
So I think it's the same. Is it the same screenwriter or screenwriters who did Ed Wood? Yeah, so like I'm kind of expecting it to be a bit similar, but.
Yeah, that's besides the point. So Derwin Martin is the bus driver, and you have Mantan Moreland as the diner guy. And Joel, do you know who...
His career goes way back. He's,
Do you know who Mantan Moreland is?
Yeah, because I watched a documentary not too long ago called... I can't remember, but it was about black film history, and you know his stuff came up, and it's like basically reviled what he was doing. But as soon as I heard this guy's voice behind the counter, I was like, "Holy crap, that's that guy!" Like he's so discernible.
Yeah, like So basically, he would play like you know like the massa roles and like
all the stereotypical like
and his whole thing, his eyes would bug out. Like,
that's always the image you see, like in, I forget, like, is there a Spike Lee film where they actually show a clip of
him? Yes, they do. Bamboozled.
Bamboozled, yeah.
The character is called Mantan.
It's obviously a reference to him and Bamboozled, right, of course. But, like, he was in Cabin in the Sky, and, like, you know, it's sort of hard to. I don't know, like, how much you can fault somebody for just, like, taking the roles that were available to them if you're, like, a working actor, but he was in, like, a lot of 1940s, 1950s films where, you know, the roles were racist caricatures, so, like, that's kind of what he's become associated with forever.
Yeah, kind of like...
Yeah,
like,
I feel like you should dislike the roles and not the man himself. I mean, he was a working actor.
Yeah, he had a family. Like I read a biography on him that was really, really poorly written. I won't say the name of it to shit on the person.
Okay.
But he had a big family. He was like a traveling I guess musician, like did like the blue circuit, not blue circuit, it's called the Chitlin circuit, like the south. Do you know what Chitlins are up in Canada?
I'm not sure. Sorry.
I don't know what it is either.
Oh wow, you guys are so uneducated. Chitlins are basically pig intestines, or maybe cow
Oh, okay.
intestines, and it's like a southern
It's
food.
like tripe a little bit, or
is it trippy?
And it's like this, like southern, like American food. And so the Chitlin Circuit is
Okay.
like Alabama, Mississippi, like Texas, like that whole section. He was real big in that area. And so like, but like he was like he had a big career, and like movies definitely helped him. But you know, like when the Civil Rights Movement happened, it kind of changed his image because like he's already not liked to begin with, but then that kind of pushed him into like even like worse territory with like with the civil rights leaders, and he kind of got forgotten. What was forgotten, and seeing him in this movie is like there's clearly a reason like why he's here, and I just love seeing it's like this. You know, he is an icon of black film. It's unfortunate, but it's still like. I like that Melvin had the foresight to like, no, I want this guy in this movie, 'cause as it's like as a nod to like this black people in American society.
And like, I don't know if you've seen the documentary, I think Classified X, where it sort of
Not yet.
talks a little bit about like Melvin Van Peebles talking about the history of like portrayals of black Americans on film. You know, like you can tell he's somebody who's familiar with the history, obviously, and passionate about it. So it's like, I don't, you know, putting a nod to cinema history in his film just through the casting, like that's, you know, to me like a very kind of, like we're gonna get a little bit into the French New Wave connection in a minute, I guess, but it just sort of made me think of that, the kind of reflexivity of like, okay, there's a certain baggage, or there's a certain weight, or you know, something that comes along when you cast a certain actor in a role that goes beyond just them playing the part.
Yeah, and like the moment, I think he has maybe three scenes, but the moment where he says like, "You set a good example for us," when Jeff comes back to his play, comes back and he's black, like that really does like get me a little emotional because this is like, it's like you have this guy who was forced into these stereotypical roles, and then you have a black character in a role that is not stereotypical. And it's like this very sweet, like acknowledging the past moment. And it's just not just, it's more than just like he's an old man, he's Manton Moreland. Like, if you know your film history, you get the significance of like him being like, basically saying, like, things are definitely getting better thanks to people like you. And Jeff can't accept it because he's a bigot. Well, at that point, he's still a bigot.
Did you hear about how the film was originally supposed to end? Watermelon Man, the original ending?
It was a nightmare, and the screenwriter
Yeah, it was all a dream.
Herman
It was all a
Rauscher,
terrible dream.
and he hated that the screenwriter Herman Rauscher hated it that Melvin dared to make it not a dream.
I know, like, Melvin Van Peebles talked a little bit about why he changed the ending. He was supposed to shoot both endings, and then he just only shot the one he wanted. So he's like, oh, well, like, you're stuck using my ending. But, you know, he said he didn't want to have the film kind of reinforce this idea that being black, it's a nightmare, and, you know, you wake up and it's all gone. And, like, you know, ending instead with him kind of. I like the training at the very end where you sort of get the impression that he's going to become like radical. And, you know, in a way, it's sort of showing, like, even though it's not the flick of a switch, it's, you know, the idea that this character you see at the beginning and what he is at the end, like this arc, it's, you know, how much the skin color can change a person in that society, you know, like what really separates, you know, ass bigot guy from, you know, where he ends up at the end of the film. So, like, I think that's, again, something that is interesting and basically saves the film and makes it watchable today instead of being something that's totally arcane and, like, you know, would be this, like, horrible, out-of-touch relic comedy otherwise.
Yeah, and it feels like the ending of, like, you know, the Black Power ending, I feel like a response yes. to the line and story of a 3-day pass where Turner says something like when is black a compliment? Or like, who thinks black is right. a compliment?
Mm.
And we should talk about the story of 3-day pass, which maybe touch on a little bit, but that was basically a French New Wave film that he did in France. And it's the story of an American soldier, Turner, and he has a 3-day pass from his base. He spends with a French woman, a white woman, and some of his white co-workers from the base see him with a white woman, and his he gets demoted, and everything good that happened to him before is undone because, you know, America is racist and you can't escape racism. Even if you're in France.
And his portrayal of racism, though, it's so much more nuanced than kind of similar films from the time. Yeah. Like, I always think it's interesting that the captain character, it's all in these, like, condescensions and insinuations. It's not like that kind of obvious somebody who proclaims their racism. It's more, I don't know, like, passive-aggressive than that, and it's more, you know, the racism with a smile, and, like, you know, we have to play this game, and really, it's just all in the subtext. Like, I think that's another thing that kind of makes it stand out, but for me, like, the performance of the film for me is Nicole Berger, the Miriam character, the woman he has the fling with, and like, it's this kind of unusual casting, because she was always sort of the neglected wife character or like best friend character. She was never like the lead, but she was in all these French New Wave films. Like, she acted with she was in films sort of like Truffaut, Godard, Romare, Chabrol, Julien Duvivier, Jules Dassin. Like, she was in like everyone's film, so, you know, this is one of her only kind of starring roles. Like, not exactly the star, but she's like the co-lead, I think. Yeah. And this was her last film, because she died, I think, like 2 days or maybe a week after her completing her scenes for the film. And I always find something just really sad. Like, I don't know if it's in the edit, like what takes were chosen or what, but like, there's something really sad and unspoken in her performance, I think. And I don't know, like, the fact that Melvin Peoples kind of treats both characters as, like, flawed, real people, and not everything is kind of said between them, and you're not sure how much of it's miscommunication or how much of it's, you know, what is, you know, what's really going on between these characters. That's kind of the thing I find sort of interesting about it. Like, at the very end, I guess to set up, like, she's sort of, you know, when she's off with him, she said, well, like, I just call in sick for work, basically, to get time off work, and I never get sick. And then, like, at the end, you know, he finally gets he gets to call her, and he calls into work, and they say, oh, she's sick, and he, like, the way he takes it is like, oh, she's off with another guy that was, like, never really, you know, did she ever really love me? But, like, it's never, like, fully explained. It's just sort of, that's what he takes away from it. And a part of me always kind of wonders, like, you know, is she really sick, or is, like, there's something else going on here? And, you know, I think, like, again, it's a film that's sort of a, you know, there's a lot going on in the subtext that I kind of am fascinated by and moved by. And I know, like, before he was making feature films, like, just his writing, you know, he had a reputation for being sort of, like, abrasive, and he was associated with the Harikiri magazine, which, like, a lot of people kind of call the French Mad magazine, even though that's not exactly right, and it's sort of, like, political and outspoken and satirical. And, like, I heard it might be in the documentary How to Eat Your Watermelon and White Company and Also Enjoy It, like, even his peers were saying, like, they didn't expect a film as gentle as Story of a 3-Day Pass from him. Like, you know, there's a sort of sensitivity there and gentleness that I think, like, it does kind of stand a little bit apart from his other films in that way. Melancholic, and I don't know, like, it has a really interesting feel to it that it makes it one of my favorites.
But it still does have like an edge of like harshness.
Oh, sure.
Like, with, like, well, like what their fantasies in particular, like that's like a real harsh like divide.
Like,
Joel, did you like,
that's such a great kind of like observation about just like how people kind of fetishize each other, and like, you know, I don't know, it feels like really kind of like raw and honest in that way. Or like even the like that whole situation where you know, the they're in that bar and he storms out and she like doesn't really understand like why he's offended or why his feelings are hurt, and like, you know, from her perspective it's like, oh, like, you know, it's not a big deal. Like the line you said about, you know, when is black a compliment, she's like, oh no, he was just like complimenting you. But you know, you see these divides and these kind of seams in the relationship where it's like, yeah, these are two imperfect people, and you know, you stick any two people together who are flawed human beings and you're going to have those sort of fault lines in a relationship. And I think like it's so well observed, and it like it's also, you know, it's a film from 1967 about an interracial relationship that's you know, it doesn't just make them like pawns in like a political statement, mm-hmm. the way that I think, you know, maybe Guess Who's Coming to Dinner kind of does. Like, I know Belvin Man Peoples was like critical of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, mm-hmm. which came out the same year, and about how perfect Sidney Poitier is. It's like, oh, you're like so perfect, we'll overcome our prejudices and you can marry our daughter. And it's like, you know, that shouldn't matter. Like, you shouldn't have to be perfect for people to acknowledge your humanity and see you as a human being. And I think like in that way, Story of a 3-Day Pass kind of feels a little bit like a response to that. You know, he's not interested in making idealized character. Yeah, like he wants to make stories about real people, and like the experiences in the film feel so kind of real and lived in, and you know, like I think probably like for any young person, relatable. Like if you've ever been away and isolated in a place where you don't necessarily speak the language or whatever, like I find that stuff really relatable.
Joel, what do you think of Story of a 3-Day Pass?
Well, it's interesting how French New Wave it is. It's just like, if you didn't tell me it was Melvin Van Peebles, movie, I would have expected it to be one of the more well-known French directors from that time. I mean, it's just the editing of just the whole bar scene thing is just not done. That wasn't being done in America at all. And like the passage of time, the developing of the relationship, it shows you in such a way, like how they could possibly grow close in, you know, the little time that they knew each other in a such a great way. And this was his movie. This was Melvin Van Peebles doing this. And it's like, I don't know what came before this. What was the inspiration for the things? Anyways.
I mean, like, there's this real confidence behind these decisions of a filmmaker who doesn't really believe in rules. Like, you know, he breaks all kinds of cinematic rules of the time period, and it feels really, like, it works. You know, that scene where he's kind of floating into the bar that Spike Lee loves so much, like, that shows up, you know, in so many of his films, that shot where, you know, the camera is fixed on the person, they're on the dolly, and they're just kind of floating.
And the other thing, like when the captain is talking directly to a camera, that feels like Do the Right Thing, the montage where they're like insulting people, or I feel like Spike got a couple of his, like, signature things like from Story of a 3-Day Pass.
I think a lot of it comes like more from Story of a 3-Day Pass than Melvin Van Peebles other films, although like you do find sort of, you know, weird formal breaks in his later films too. But like I think Story of a 3-Day Pass, again, like you said, it could could have been a European filmmaker, and I think some people assumed it was when it won at the San Francisco Film Festival. He talked about, like, oh, you know, when he came back to the States, you know, the limousine driver, you know, person sent to pick him up, they're like, Monsieur Van Peebles, not realizing, I guess because of the name Van Peebles, it could be, you know, could be a European filmmaker, but people didn't realize he was American. Or, like, have you seen the film Badass that's about the making of Sweet Sweetback's Badass song that Mario Van Peebles made?
I have not.
Okay, like, there's one scene where some of the crew get arrested and, like, put in jail because the police are saying, oh, you know, they must have stolen this equipment. And Melvin Van Peebles doesn't want to go down to the station in person because, like, as long as he's over the phone or at a distance, he's just, you know, he could be this, like, European filmmaker. So, you know, I think, like, people sort of made that assumption about him, actually, when he came back. And that's kind of maybe why certain doors were open to him. Because, like, originally his short films, he said he did try to find a job in Hollywood, I think, before he left for Europe. And he said, well, you know, he went to a studio, I'm not sure which one, like, looking for a job. And they said, well, you know, we watched your short films and we can give you a job as an elevator operator. So he kind of, you know, wasn't going to get into Hollywood that way. So, like, I think he just had to prove that he was, like, a natural born filmmaker and better. And that's kind of, you know, in some ways, he kind of beat Hollywood at its own game by letting, by getting them to let him in and then sort of burning up a contract. you know, I think, like, that's kind of, you know, typical of Melvin and Peebles in a way. But, yeah, like, I don't know. It is sort of a weird blend of, like, on one hand, it feels so European, sort of a 3-day pass, but it's also clearly from an American's perspective, and American's the main character. And, you know, it's this sort of weird mishmash of, like, yeah, this is a French New Wave film made by an American that's sort of interesting.
Yeah, like, what's
this? He had a really good cinematographer, too, Mikhail Kelber, who was, I think he was originally from Ukraine, but he left for France, and he shot, like, a lot of these old classic, like, French realist movies, poetic realist films. He worked with Renoir, he worked with Cocteau. I don't know if you know the movie Zuzu with Josephine Baker.
No.
Okay, like, Mikhail Kelber shot that. So, like, Melvin Van Peebles said that, you know, because it was his first feature film, like, he had this experienced cinematographer, and he was kind of like, okay, I got your back, and, you know, just whatever you want, I'll make it work, basically. So, like, it was a really good pairing, I think. But, like, again, there's that confidence and there's that sort of natural instinct of what's going to work and what doesn't. That's really remarkable. I think, like, again, in one of these documentaries, Melvin Van Peebles talked about shooting his first films, you know, just getting film and kind of learning how it works. And, like, oh, okay, like, I'm, you know, trying to edit in the camera and kind of learning how it works, splicing, and how you have to, you know, work from the negative to get a positive. But, you know, he talked about, like, the first thing he ever shot, first piece of film, you know, setting up the little projector and playing it under his son's crib. In, you know, that was, like, the one dark place in their home. And he said, you know, he watched the images come up and he thought it was going to be bad or, like, amateurish. And he said, like, no, it was a real film. And, you know, I think the expression he used was, like, you know, I got you now, life. Like, I have you by the balls now, life. I know what I'm doing and nobody can stop me. So, like, I think he just kind of always had that approach and attitude and, you know, understood how good he was and could fall back on that. I don't, like, the story with 3-Day Pass, it was also released as La Permission in France. So it's, there's the French release, and then I always noticed, like, the American release, which came the following year in 1968, it was, like, 20 minutes shorter, or 60 minutes shorter. Like, it was chopped down quite a bit, and I was never really sure what they cut out of it, if it was, like, the sex scenes, or, like, that's kind of my instinct, is, like, that's probably what got cut out of it for the American release. But I always sort of wondered if maybe that's part of the reason why it wasn't, like, more widely received and acclaimed. Like, the response at the San Francisco Film Festival was so strong that, like, when it finally got a general release and you read the reviews, like, a lot of them are kind of negative or sort of dismissive, and like that never really felt right to me. And I don't, like, he has kind of a strange legacy. Like, even, you know, like, Sweetback's considered this important sort of seminal film, you know, independent film, but like, it always kind of felt weird to me that it inspired a bunch of exploitation films, basically. And yeah, like, you know, not to dismiss those films, like, those all have inherent value too, but it's like,
it's not even
like, if somebody saw Godard's Weekend and was like, okay, let's make a bunch of movies that are like exploitation films that are like Godard's Weekend, you know, like, it's such a sort of a weird thing that kind of it spawned in a way that, like, I don't know, like, it just,
yeah, like, in the Cotton Comes Harlem episode, we talked about how, like, Sweetback isn't exploitation at all.
No, it's like, it's an art house, like, political polemic, like an angry intellectual's polemic. It's like a Godard film. It, you know, the text that shows up, the weird editing, like, you know, I think, like, you could put it on a double bill with, like, you know, a Godard film from around the same period, and people wouldn't bat an eyelash. Like, that kind of, it's an art house film, and then, you know, what people took away from it is, like, the sex and the violence and the kind of coolness of, you know, him in the outfit and the black hat and all that, which, like, you know, I appreciate that that's, like, a part of film history, but it's just, like, I don't know, I always feel like it should have rocked, you know, not just the fringes of cinema to its core, but, like, American cinema as a whole, like, could have changed when films like that come out and how things are edited and just the stories being told. But I don't know, that's always, like, my feeling, is that it kind of went, you know, Van Peebles has always been, like, a little bit underacclaimed in America, maybe, or, like, not as appreciated as he should be. He can be a little, like, self-aggrandizing in person. If you ever see him do, like, interviews or stuff, like, he's not shy about, like, yes, I'm that good, yes, I'm that smart, which, like, you know, in some ways, like, I respect. If, like, nobody else is going to acclaim you, you might as well, you know.
Since we're talking about Sweetback, I think it should be noted that, first, there's that weird scene with Mario Van Peebles.
Right, the sex scene at the beginning.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know, a part of me always wonders, too, though, like, how much of that's true, because, like, if it's, like, one of those stories that comes out of the film, or, I don't know, like, I guess so, but...
I saw it the first time, I was like, wait a second, that's a kid and a fully grown woman, that's just a weird...
I know.
That's just a weird thing to shoot. And it's his own
son. Even that, like, sort of makes me think of, like, just, like, the kind of, I don't know, like, the way that Europeans films will sometimes, like, not shy away from, like, I don't know.
Like Argento
weird with his situations daughters. With kids. Well, I was even thinking of, like, Berkman, but, you know, yeah, like, there's lots of examples, but it, like, you know, when you watch that in Sweetback, it's like, oh, yeah, this is weird. Like, American cinema doesn't go near here usually. Like, it's uncomfortable, actually, when you watch it, but...
Yeah. And also, Bill Cosby funded it.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. But they were. I did see an interview with Melvin recently.
Well, when he distanced himself from him.
Yeah, and he didn't outright say, I think Bill did everything, but he did say, like, you know, like, I talked to Bill.
Didn't he say, like, I think he could have?
Yeah.
Was, like, sort of his answer. Yeah. Like, he could. Which, you know, that's not like a.
And he also not, said,
really a defense or anything.
Yeah, in an interview, I asked him, like, well, did you, are you friends with him? And he said, I talked to him twice in my whole life, and that's about it.
Yeah, like, I think he was just a financier, and that was it, basically. Like, if you understand how it came to be, it's like, oh, you know, the Cosby money came through, and that was it. Like, I think he just had no real association with them, so... You know, it's a weird association now, but really, like, I don't think they ever had much to do with each other.
No, he may seem like they were just like, it is just purely money for that one thing only, and nothing else after that.
Yeah.
Which I guess is good for, you know, a good hindsight, but yeah.
Yeah. I forget which, like, Dave Chappelle special it is when he's talking about Cosby, but One of the recent ones, but it just made me think of that. people know it if they see it.
So like a theme between these two movies is like white women,
right?
Which although he was married to a white woman for a long time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he also like had numerous affairs while he was married to her.
Yeah, I kind of figured that. But based off the sweet back stuff,
like, I think like one of the documentaries about him, like talking about while he was living in France, they said, "Oh, you needed like 3 telephone numbers to try to get in touch with him," and it was like, you know, one woman for, you know, Monday, Wednesday, one for Tuesday, Thursday, one for the weekend. I guess that's kind of how he was, but yeah, I guess we didn't really talk about Estelle Parsons that much, but she's kind of she's still alive. Like she's just like long time.
Yeah, I was shocked.
Cinema stalwart.
Yeah, I thought she died like in the '80s.
Because she's in like Bonnie and Clyde in a smaller role, and yeah, like
she won an Oscar for something. Like I think she won an Oscar at that point, so like she had, you know, some acclaim.
Yeah.
And then the guy who plays the boss was a sitcom guy. Like it's a bunch of sitcom actors filling that, which makes sense.
I guess because like it's a comedy, so
yeah, and it feels like like his version of like American sitcom, where like Jeff is like this generic sitcom dad who he's a businessman. And he's loud and annoying, right. And he's a funny one. It just feels like Godfrey, like, he gets to make fun of, like, the, like, Father Knows Best and Dick Van Dyke. He gets to make fun of, like, all that type of stuff.
Like, them sitting around the TV, or, like, the kind of, like, you know, family of two kids. And it's, even the way it's shot, like, it feels very, like, three-wall kind of sitcom-y for a lot of it.
And Anne Moran is, from Happy Days, is the daughter.
Oh, okay. That's Joni from Joni Loves Chachi, right?
I believe so.
But maybe I might have that wrong, but
yeah, but you know, like so there's a whole pedigree of like sitcom, like the American sitcom of the time, which I don't like the term dated, but kind of does date it a little bit.
It is like I think like this is one where it's kind of fair to say, but like you know, it's better off that the film be like a little bit dated than like I don't know, like can you imagine like, you know, if they just had like a white director who kind of didn't think about it and like made it with Alan Arkin and made it with the original ending, like it would have been so awful. I just keep thinking about like, yeah, you basically saved the film, you know.
it would be awful and probably be forgotten in like a legend, because I feel like the studio would bury it if that happened.
Do you know do you know that the film Soul Man?
Yeah,
it's like a blackface comedy from like the late 80s. Like it's weird how like tone deaf studios can be with that stuff. And
yeah, that's been on my list of I have to see that at some point.
Oh, no, you don't.
Really?
It's like even out of like morbid curiosity, I'm not sure. Like, maybe one viewing, but
No, there's no reason to watch that, Spencer.
It's worth it to know like, what it is, here? But like,
yes, I'm just listening for my moment.
Okay,
sorry, Joel. But did you hear about the whole like blackface scandal in Canada recently?
I have. Joel, have you heard of it? Heard about this recent one?
No, I can't say I have.
Like, Prime Minister of Canada, like, wearing black and brown face on multiple occasions. Like, it's
in the year 2000? 2001?
I think, like, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago or, like, older, but
he was a teacher at the time.
Like, I think there's one picture where he's, like, in high school, and then one where he's a teacher at, like, a party, and like it's just multiple occasions, but I don't know.
So weird. It was for educational purposes.
Oh, it's just terrible.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys listened to Retail Nightmares. It's a Canadian podcast, and one of the hosts had him as a teacher when she was in high school. And like when he was running for prime minister, she was always talking about how she can't take him seriously because he's such a goofy
Yeah.
teacher.
Yeah.
But I can't wait to
But
hear when she talks about the blackface thing. I feel like.
what's weird is like how many people like how quick some people were to defend it all of a sudden. Like, I don't know. Like, not to get like too political on the show, but there's a lot of people who
It's
are
a
right now
Spike
are
Lee
like,
podcast. You can get pretty political.
okay. Like, I don't know. Like, it's weird running into like liberal Canadians who are defending blackface all of a sudden. Like, I feel like anyone else, it would be, completely shut down and criticized. But like,
I
it's
mean,
so annoying. It's so
funny how you bring
awful.
up white liberals when we're
Right.
a Watermelon Man, which feels kind of like Get Out. Took from it a little bit
Yeah,
of the
yeah.
hypocrisy of like white liberalism of like, you can say you support, the civil rights of a minority, but like when your spouse becomes one, it's like, I don't know about that.
I mean, like, just from my own experience in Canada, there's no shortage of closet racist white liberals. Like, I don't know if that's surprising to anyone, but
As a black person, mixed but still black, no, not surprised.
no, I don't know. Like, I never like felt like a part of that, and it's just like weird to see. Like when you get like a room full of like white people together, like what'll come out? It's
I've
so
heard legend of
shitty.
that, but if I'm in a room, then it's not all white people, so. And I look vaguely ethnic
Right.
enough that people don't I don't get like the weird white racist thing of like, hey, you're another white person. What do you think those people? Like, that's never happened to me.
I'm like, just thinking back to like Story of a 3-Day Pass, there's like some stuff, like when he's going around the city, and there's these presumably like French-speaking Black Africans there, and they kind of like nod at him, and it's just like that acknowledgement of, oh, okay, like I see that you're kind of like out of place too, and like we don't have any, like we don't know each other, but like I'm gonna acknowledge that, like I see you. And just I remember, like when I was staying in China, you would like go past like another like white tourist, and they'd give you a nod. I'm like, what are you nodding at me for? Like, I don't know you. Like, don't do that. But
Safety in numbers.
stupid.
Yeah, going to
I don't know.
Watermelon
I'd
Man.
like.
I love when she sees him, and when he's black for the first time, and she
Yeah.
yells like, "Oh, there's a Negro in the house. He's going to kill me."
God. It just how like long it goes on for where he's like in total denial. Like they stretch it out so long.
And
Well, it's funny like how different characters react to it, whether it's like denial or it's like I've always known, which is like a weird one too, or I never noticed. Like it gets all these different reactions.
Also the reveal of him being black is his ass, which is a great, like, very
Yeah.
crude, like, but a pointed joke because you get an ass shot when he's in whiteface. When he's,
Right.
like, I guess, like, doing like, swimming? I don't know what that machine was.
No, he's tanning. What are you talking about?
But he was, like, moving his
The tanning
arms at the
machine?
same time. So he was doing something else while tanning.
Oh, no, yeah, he was like lifting weights while he was tanning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all white people do that. I guess you wouldn't know.
Well, you're half Mexican. How do you know?
No, listen, I can pass, okay? I'm the secret Mexican.
Even just like.
People don't know, so they're doing all kinds of white things in front of me. You have no idea.
When you start reading about the history of it, and like you realize like how much bullshit there is, like go back 100 years and see like, oh, like this group of people was considered white and this one wasn't, and it's completely arbitrary. Like I don't, like I'm Slavic. I wouldn't have been considered white in America 100 years ago, or but like Syrian people would have been, or like it's just the sort of racial politics are always kind of like changing and arbitrary and ugly. Like it's, I don't know, it's gonna be
I mean, humans will always be shitty to each other. You can't really
Yeah.
can't stop that.
Like, have you seen the movie Europa Europa?
That Lars one.
No, the other Europa, not the Zentropa Europa.
No.
About it's sort of about this Jewish boy who ends up getting, like, they don't realize he's Jewish, and he ends up sort of adopted into like a Nazi society during World War II. And there's like the scene where, I'll come up to the front of the class and we'll like show how we can, determine your race based on like measuring your face and your skull and your eyes. And he's worried he's gonna get found out, like, oh no, they're gonna realize I'm not actually or they're gonna realize I'm Jewish. And they take all these measurements, and he's like, ah yes, like, as you can see, maybe from one of the darker tribes, but clearly an Aryan. And like, he just sort of realizes all in this like one instant that it's complete bullshit. Like, and I don't know, like, on one hand, like, it feels totally naive to be like, oh yeah, I want to be colorblind and ignore all that stuff, because, like, yeah, we're not, like, that's just sort of the reality of how people are. But I don't know, like, it's sort of like you can acknowledge that, yeah, it matters, but maybe it shouldn't, or it shouldn't matter all that much. I feel like that's kind of where I'm at with that.
It matters, but it, yeah, I don't know. It's a
It
stupid
matters, but
culture
like,
that gets in the way.
yeah, right.
Yeah, like
And like,
Joel, you mentioned something about the tanning, which like going like to quote Paul Mooney, everybody wants to be a nigga, but no one wants to be a nigga. It's just like every like this black culture is just like seen as this like oh it's hip and cool, but this other people, well, white people, this kind of always want to appropriate it, or they want to
co-opted,
get
or
tan
yeah.
and get darker, and it's like oh okay. It's just so
Right, yeah. It
weird.
slightly subver gonna be slightly subversive, right? But only to white people. But also, yeah.
But like, if you're talking about like the history of America, though, I always felt like you look at Black Americans, like, that's, in some ways part of the, like, one of the biggest parts of like the American cultural heritage is Black American history, and like how much of culture comes from that. And I know there are people who are like, oh, like, Black American history is just American history, and have that kind of feeling. But it's like a distinct, if you look at like a Black Americans as like a distinct group, in the way that, like, I don't know, other countries have like visible minorities, there's like such a big cultural center or cultural heart to it, like the music, the history. I don't, like, I'm sort of rambling now, but
Yeah, I mean,
it's
everything,
weird
like
for people
fat,
to
like
kind of like
fashion,
either dismiss that or dilute it. Like, it's like one or the other for some people, where it's like either, oh, that doesn't count, or else it's like, oh yeah, that's American history, that belongs to all of us. Like, I don't know.
don't know, like I don't know, maybe this is off track, but I have mixed feelings on Black History Month, because on one hand,
Right.
it's important to highlight it, but on the other hand, like it just makes it seem like the other, like for that one month when suddenly a bunch of websites suddenly give a shit, and then suddenly a bunch of corporations give a shit for 28 days,
Right.
and then the rest of the year it's next to nothing. So like I don't know, it's just a complex weird thing.
I know.
Like there's no easy answer to it.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. I like what Marcus said about, like, there's no perfect film about dealing with race, because, like, it's a messy issue. So, like, in that way, like, I think what you're doing in the podcast, like, looking at Spike Lee films, he's a filmmaker who, like, my favorite films of his are messy, actually. And like, to some extent, I think it's true. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm in the same category. I like his messier ones, like Bamboozled, like more
Yeah.
than his more formal ones, like BlacKkKlansman.
Right, for sure. Like, I don't know, like, it's an issue where I feel like like, it's not just one issue, it's a bunch of issues, and you can come away with conflicted feelings or open-ended ideas or all sorts of things, you know, and kind of, you know, in some ways, like, it's better for a film to be confrontational when you're discussing issues like that than kind of making a single point. And, you know, like, getting back to Van Peebles, that's sort of how I feel about, you know, these two films anyway. Like, they feel very... Mm-hmm. I don't want to say messy, but they feel like they touch on so many different things and kind of raise different feelings, and you can kind of look at them from different perspectives. Yeah. You know, so in that way, like, I think, like, you know, more than just the style, I wonder if Spike Lee's kind of drawing on that as well. You know, like the kind of,
like,
the all over the place editing, that, like, jump cuts, the kind of, like, that style, it sort of extends to the narrative as well. You know, like, you'll feel like, oh, like, I'm watching a sweet love story, and then he'll throw something in, like, that the kind of imagined dream sequence they have of each other, or, like, you know, he'll throw a wrench in it, because, again, like, people are flawed, and it's a messy issue, and, you know, I sort of feel like that the kind of, like, typical Oscar film that deals with race, where you kind of come out, mm-hmm. and it's like, oh, like, the movie solved racism, Crash solved racism, there it is, you know, like, there's so many of those that I appreciate films that kind of actually leave you feeling, like, worse and messier, and, you know, like, not necessarily, like, the green books of cinema. Like, I don't... Have you seen The Landlord?
Yeah.
Like, I don't... The first Hal Ashby film, I think that also came out in 1970.
Oh.
So, like, I don't know how much of that's a watershed year, but, like...
I have the Blu-ray, but I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll build guns.
Brilliant film, like... I was about to, like, Hal Ashby directed, but Bill Gunn did the screenplay. And, like, one thing I really love about that film, for people who haven't seen it, is, like, you know, you could have done a version where, like, oh, the landlord comes in and, like, you know, we, like, learn things from each other and we're all better off by the end. But, like, no, everything gets, like, messier, and everyone's kind of in a worse place by the end than they were at the beginning. And it's just sort of, you know, that's how you feel when you look at, like, issues surrounding racism. It's like, even just to try to tackle it, sometimes you feel like you come out worse than when you went into it. But
yeah,
I don't know. Again, I'm sort of, like, spaced out right now, so I don't know if any of that made sense. Yeah, but that's kind of just how I feel about it.
When we're talking about Van Peebles, like, it will happen. But
I know. Well, like, I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but, like, I'll watch. Like, especially Story of a Three-Day Pass, and, like, my mind goes in, like, a million different directions. You know, it's just,
like,
it doesn't feel like a film with, like, a clear thesis, you know, it's, but at the same time, it's full of ideas, and it doesn't feel, like, unfocused either. You know, it's just, like, oh, like, there's so many different little avenues to go down, and for, you know, a film like that, it's very deceptively simple.
Yeah, like, one of the big things about that I personally love is, like, you carry, like, racism follows him everywhere, and, like, he carries, like, the weight of, like, the racial history of Black Americans with him. Something that I, you know, like Joel, you probably feel it too. Like, you carry, like, the weight of, like, the racial history of, you know, whatever you are with you at all times. You know, whether you, like, you do it on purpose or not on purpose, but, like, I whether
mean, yeah. Living in Southern California, especially, it just makes you have to carry that stuff with you, because otherwise, I mean, it'd be the way everything is here. It's the way Martin, you were talking. Who am I talking to?
I'm Martin. I'm
yes,
here.
That's what I thought. Okay,
right.
I'm tripping. You were saying that, like, history, Black history, or just the history of America type thing. It's like they can't, when it comes to racial history,
yes,
like, Americans like to make it seem like things were just folded in and it got better and better over time, and that's an easy way to move past it. That's why there's so many freaking people in this country that think racism is solved, you know, like, that insane thing. It's just, well, like I
remember hearing, like, I think, like, there's even an SNL skit about it, like, when Donald Trump got elected, you have people like, wait, America's racist now? Like, you know, like, people not realize, you know, you live in some kind of a bubble, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, like, it's so, I don't know, like, it's sad, but it's like fundamentally tied to the history of America. It's like,
well, is there anything like with like your family, you're Czech, so like, is there anything like with the
Holocaust and like the, I mean, you know, it's not exactly the same, but like it's you know, in some ways like comparable. You know, you look at the history of slavery, which, you know, it's a little bit older, but like it, you know, comparing that to the legacy of the Holocaust and just the kind of impression it made, and you know, knowing that there's like people in my family that affected, or you know, having grand uncles who decided not to be Jewish all of a sudden, you know, like I know it's not the same, so like me kind of trying to apply that to American history, I'm gonna obviously like run into problems, or you know, it's not going to be like a one for one thing, but you know, when you hear about like, I don't know, like you know, reading books about like Ethel Waters or people like that talking about the idea of like, oh, passing as white or things like that, you can sort of start to, you know, maybe a little bit relate to, like on that level, thinking about just how it's advantageous in certain circumstances or certain times or places to not be the person you're born as. And it's a sad fact, but you know, that's, you know, for a country like America, that's what it's kind of always been.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I think, you know, part of the work of artists, and you look at Melvin Van Peebles as an artist, I think it's to help, or not even help, it's just to like try to break that down and kind of challenge that in a way. You know, like him talking about Sidney Poitier saying like, oh, you know, like all but walk on water. Like, I think, you know, in a way, what's the most confrontational aspect of Melvin Van Peebles' films to like, you know, America as a whole? It's the honesty, the humanity. Like, that's the most confrontational stuff in it. It's not the, you know, jokes or the sex or the violence. Like, that's in some ways kind of besides the fact. I think like just being honest is enough to kind of challenge the status quo in a country where you have something wrong, because, you know, the things that are wrong kind of come from, you know, something that's like philosophically untrue in a way. Like, that's sort of how I feel about it. Like, it's like,
that's all over, you know, like these two movies. Like, even though Watermelon Man is like, starts out like a goofy family, like, sitcom, like it turns into this like radical, like, movie. It's about like a black identity in America. And like every scene has like something like some comment on it. Like, and the part I always go back to is when Jeff has sex with a Norwegian woman. So like early on, he's like, Swedish, Norwegian, it doesn't matter.
Swedish, Norwegian, as long as you're blonde, he says.
Yeah, and then like,
but like
when they after they have sex, and he's and she's like, oh, you probably have some other black friends too, and then he's trying to out her as a bigot, and she calls him a nigger. She's like, oh, you passed for American citizenship,
right? But like, just like how much of a jerk ass he is. It's like, I know it's. It's not always funny, but I think it's pretty funny how much of a jerk he is in the film. But, like, you know, just, yeah, like, the, you know, that's the kind of challenging aspect, is showing people are, like, flawed or human or sympathetic or, like, I mean, he talked about the American perception to A Story of a Three-Day Pass before. He said, you know, like, a lot of the negative reviews basically boil down to, like, oh, like, it's not interesting because he doesn't portray, like, the black character as a victim, basically, like... you know, that's one thing, like, I think he's always kind of resisted in his films, is just, like, this idea that his movies aren't about, like, black characters suffering on screen or being victimized, and it's like, you know, you can be forlorn in love and heartbroken, you can be a jerk-ass former bigot who sort of reinvents himself, you know, or you can be a, you know, urban Avenger like Sweetback, but you know, he wanted to, I think, break those typical narratives of you know, the way black people were portrayed in American films, the sort of, you know, Mantan characters we touched on earlier.
Still there?
I guess.
Oh, okay.
I feel like I don't know, I kind of went a little bit rambly, but no, I don't know fine. If people got anything out of that.
No, like, I don't know, like, these two movies really bring that out. Like, we barely talked about them, yeah. but, like, they're so full of this, you know, this ideas and feelings of, like, this is what, of, like, you know, race in America. So, like,
right.
even though one, like, even though one's French New Wave, basically, it's still very much yeah. about race in America.
Well, like, I don't know. I don't know if it's, like, weird for me to say, like, how much I relate to the story of A Three-Day Pass, but, mm-hmm. like, you know, there are ways where I find it, like, very relatable. Not in spite of the racial issues, but it's just, like, there's ways that I feel like, oh, I can connect with this film so strongly and personally, and it's not...
Yeah, it did,
like, I don't know, like, it just feels like it's, like, real and relatable, and, you know, he's putting something personal up on screen that's kind of, like... out there for you to connect to. And because the film's so much about human connection and like how much can you really relate to somebody else, how much can you really understand somebody else, am I loving this person as much as they're loving me, like I think, you know, that's sort of a universal theme that yeah you can draw sort of you know racial politics out of, but like that almost feels like, you know, that's just one tributary of kind of a broader thing that he's exploring in it.
I was saying the movie is incredibly relatable, like, and the parts that I feel I don't relate to, I still do in a sense, like, because the perspective is him as an American, African American in that case, you know, him basically suffering a kind of a form of PTSD, when he's just so expecting a certain reaction from people around him, and when they're at that restaurant, and the Spanish singer, what does he say? He calls him a
Mr.
Negrito,
something like that.
Yeah, when he said that word, anyway, I shouldn't be saying that word, anyways. But like, I cringed because not to go into my own personal history too much, but that's a word my grandmother was saying when she was in hospice about a certain nurse, and my dad was like, mom, you can't say that, mom. But it's like, yeah, like, and from the perspective of the Spanish singer guy, he wasn't saying anything.
Like, it's,
yeah. And also from the lady he was with, it was also no big deal, but it's like, that's the whole point. Like, it is a big deal. Like, okay, maybe in your culture, they can get away
like
with it.
Her trying to explain to him that, like, oh, like, her trying to say it's not a big deal doesn't lessen the way it made him feel. Like,
absolutely.
I think she doesn't understand that, you know, like, that scene under the bridge. And, you know, like, maybe not that specifically, but I, like, again, there's so many things that the character goes through that he feels... the loneliness or the kind of, I don't know, condescension, or, you know, there's so many things that I think are really,
yeah. It's like, yes.
For anyone to connect to, like, I think, you know, that it's a film that can have meaning for anyone watching it.
Yeah. Like going to the American military aspect, my grandpa was in the military for 30 years, Air Force, mm-hmm. and he wanted to be a pilot. And so he went to flight school through the military, and he told me all the people who were picked to be a pilot were white, and if you were a colored person, then you would get something else. And my grandpa got navigator because he's really good at math and has like a master's degree in math and went to the Bronx High School of Science and shit like that. But like, you know, and he told me, you know, so, and like when he grew up in New York City, where it wasn't segregated, it was all integrated pretty much. And like, and when he was stationed to Texas, he and my grandma for the first time had to go to a colored section of the air base, and had to go to a colored section of restaurants. And they are so talking about how like it's this huge, like insane shift of like New York City. And, you know, it's all in the same country, but like in New York City, like, you know, everyone tolerates each other enough, you know, to get by. but once they got to Texas, it's like everything's like, oh no, they, since they're a wrong skin color, they have to go to the other part of their base and of the town simply because, of just how they looked.
And that goes back to Watermelon Man. I feel like that's they're living in a neighborhood where they feel like, oh, of course a black person can be around or something like that. So, I mean, you can't live here or anything like that. And you're saying you couldn't get the job as a pilot. I was thinking of Paul Williams, who I just watched Phantom of the Paradise for the first time recently. I was like, oh, this guy again.
The
he's like
Muppets
17
composer.
years, 17 years in insurance. I've got just the job for you working at a dump. exactly what happens.
I think it was Melvin Van Peebles was I forget if he was the navigator or he was on airplanes. He was in the Air Force, I think in the 1950s, and he said something similar about how, like, he'd get passed up for promotion, or like there was basically, the other guys coming out of the Air Force all had like jobs and he didn't, but that's why he went to Holland to get an education. But I don't know, it's
Yeah, and like it's a like as you know, like Watermelon Man is very dated in a certain way, but it's still incredibly relevant. Like a lot of the general ideas are still like, yeah, that's America 50 years later. It hasn't changed that much. We like to think it did because of Barack Obama, but it didn't. Like that because look who's president now. Like that's a clear sign of things aren't as progressive as certain people like to assume they are.
Well, again, like Story of a 3-Day Pass, that captain character, that kind of like
He's like, oh, you went.
racism that won't admit it's racism. Like, I feel like, in a way, that's some of the sharpest criticism in that film, because, like, I from what I see, like, racism today looks more like that. You do have people being like outspoken, emboldened bigots, that exist too, but I feel like just a lot of the kind of like day-to-day stuff that you see, it's a little bit more like that, this sort of insidious, like, I'm gonna pretend that I'm not racist kind of a thing.
Yeah, I work at a nursing home, and I can tell you some of the residents are still outwardly racist. Like I
Yeah,
hear
sure.
if they like if I at a home I worked at before, like some people if they saw like a Japanese car or like heard like a Japanese word, they would say the slur for Japanese person. Because to them, it's like they bombed us during Pearl Harbor, and they still felt that anger towards them, 70 years later. And like the certain other slurs I would hear from like people in their 80s and 90s, and you can't say anything because they're 90 years old, and
Yeah,
like
that's the
they don't
thing.
give a shit what your
You
opinion
can only
is.
say so much to somebody who's like in their 90s.
Sure, you can say something, or
It's true, but
otherwise
like
you can
it's not
stick a
gonna have
sock in
like
her
an
mouth.
oh my
Yeah, but
God. Like you can tell him, but you kind of know, like, all oh, right, like
it's not a battle not worth fighting for.
see,
sure,
listen,
get in
this.
an argument with an old
I
person.
assume that person's gonna die soon. I want them to know that I don't like them before they die, so I'm gonna let them know my opinion.
Well, one of them,
But
their
like
kids didn't like
people
him and
closer to our
everything.
age, I feel like it's all more in like euphemisms. It's in like, I don't know, not even like a winking way. It's just like under the surface. It's this sort of, this infection that like the skin's kind of grown over on top of, and people think it's gone, but the infection's still there and it's like festering. And sometimes like the pus comes to the surface and everyone can kind of very easily point and say, like, oh, look, there's racism. That's bad. But, for the rest of the time, it's just kind of hanging out, being nasty, and like, you can't really, it's hard to pinpoint, and it's hard to kind of
Yeah, I mean, like
call it out, I
Turner
guess.
gets like oh, you're one of the good ones talk, which now Joel, has that ever happened to you? Has anyone been told you like, oh, you're one of the good ones?
I mean, more or less. I mean, my growing up was that way. Like all through high school and stuff like that, because I was the token beaner, I guess. You know, in my group, I don't look Mexican, but everyone knew I was Mexican, and my father taught at the high school he was, and he definitely looks Mexican. So, you know, they could say jokes about that, and then kind of like elbow me, and you know, like, ha ha ha, yeah, you guys are funny, all right, and, sure, whatever.
Okay, I had
assumed... It took me a long time to come to terms with how fucked up that was.
I have a similar thing. Elementary and junior high with predominantly white school. Now it's more racially mixed with like African families and Filipino families. But when I went there, like I was the one, no white kid. And so there was a little of like, oh, you're one of the good ones because you have clean cut hair and you don't live in the bad parts of Delaware and stuff like that. And in college, a weird thing happened where I hung out with some. I went to college in West Virginia, where my dad's from, and West Virginia is. There's some real isolated parts of that state, and I had one friend who told me one day, like, "I like you because you're not a nigger. You're just a black person."
I thought that was okay.
Yeah, and I told him, well, don't say that, or don't say that word to me anymore. And he never said that around me anymore. But I know there are other black people hung around with that, that ran our same circles that I knew for a fact, like, he would use that word to describe them. Because, like, you know, they were more, you know, ghetto and more hood. And, you know,
he watched one Chris Rock special, and now he's an expert.
Yeah.
No. I mean, like, I'm European, so, like, I don't get this directly. Like, I don't want to get, like, too much into my personal life, but, like, more my significant other would... I hear a lot of that kind of secondhand. Maybe not a lot. Like, it's not, like, every day or every week, but once in a while you hear something kind of come back and you're like, ugh, like people, you know, and you would think here in Canada, people would probably care less than like anywhere else, but it still happens. Like it still comes up and you realize people are still like that. But like, usually it's more like, I always think when people are overly nice, sometimes it makes me raise an eyebrow. Like, I don't know, like, if you've ever been in a relationship where people kind of, like, draw attention to, like, differences between you and a partner, where it's sort of... I feel like I'm talking really vague, but, like, people are sort of overly enthusiastic in a way that's kind of, like, unsettling. I don't know if anyone's run into that.
My girlfriend, who is white, her boss who is a white woman, has a couple kids. One of her kids refers to me as Mary's black boyfriend. But the kid's like three or four, so she doesn't realize what she's saying. So it's just it's funny now. But hopefully
she's indicating that Mary has several boyfriends of various shades. Is what's going on here. I was gonna say I've seen that episode of Saved by the Bell where the kid in the wheelchair, Zach keeps pointing out, and he's handicapped, and finally has to be like, "Listen, dude, you don't have to keep saying that." Like, oh. yeah
so hey guys
well guys did we
do anyways,
we
those two movies were good.
Yeah, Martin, I think we saved racism.
I'm gonna go watch racism.
I don't know,
we racism lives to fight another day.
Yeah, so like, Joel, did you like these two movies?
Yeah, I liked them both a lot. I was very weary of Watermelon Man. Like, I didn't, you know, like I said, I found that beginning part so off-putting, and I knew what he was doing, overplaying it. But like, once the turn happens, I feel like it got this rhythm that I was really into. You guys have both talked repeatedly about that ending. Like, it makes it so interesting and special in a way that, like, I was not expecting. You know, the dream ending, that's the ending I expected.
Yeah.
because it just makes sense in like a in a Hollywood movie.
Hollywood.
Can you imagine Hollywood making a movie like this now?
It would have the dream ending.
Do you think they even dare to tackle something so?
I don't know.
Hollywood's idea of tackling sometimes. Something like that, like Hollywood is pretty stupid sometimes. But like, you know, the way they would like, you know, quote unquote tackle it, it would be like another Green Book. You know, that's their idea of tackling it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, one last thing. Godfrey Cambridge in this movie looks like he could play Wesley Snipes' dad if he will live long enough. It makes me really hope maybe there's a biopic of Godfrey Cambridge at the end of his life, played by Wesley Snipes.
Well, I would say in his white man form, he could play Jiminy Glick's brother.
Oh, God, yeah.
What the hell? Martin Short? No, it's the other guy.
But to me, he looks a lot like Wesley Snipes.
Yeah. And yeah. As for 3 Day Pass, I also thought that was really good. And, you know, Spencer and I've had discussions where, you know, you're kind of middling on the French New Wave because of how many you've seen and what you've seen.
Yeah.
I feel honestly almost the same way, mm-hmm. like specifically about Godard. I've seen like four of his movies. Mm-hmm. And it's like two of them I was like, ugh. And the other two I was like, wow. And this is 3 Day Pass is such a solid movie, not just because of its French New Wave styling, but how the character deals with what's going on and the American African American perspective is just like so clear in it. I almost want to have somebody who is an idiot watch the movie and mm-hmm. tell me what he thinks it's about, because I want to know what a normal I don't want to say normal, that's a bad thing to say. I just want to hear somebody who's not as into racial politics possibly watch and be like, oh, that was a weird movie.
Well, like, I'm curious, how do you feel about the ending? Like, you know, when he's excited and he runs to the phone and he calls and he figures that she's off with somebody else. Like, you know, how does it make you feel, or what do you think is going on in that scene?
I mean, that makes perfect sense in his world, mm-hmm. that she, you know, she's not actually sick. She's just pretending to be sick. There's no way he can possibly know that.
It's a very like young man, like, oh, she didn't text me back, she must hate me kind of a reaction. Exactly. Like,
and him, him specifically, like, I was just a fling for him, a wild thing. And that also plays into something about the dream sequence they were having when they were, making out for the first time, where we see him and he imagines himself as this, like, Lothario, you know, riding, and meeting this woman who's just waiting for him. And then it kind of zooms in on hers. And even though it's supposed to, I think the intention is, like, this is what her thoughts are, I really think it's his thoughts. Like, she's thinking, oh, this is a African man, and the tribe is around, and oh, man, this is exactly what I want. I don't actually think that's what she's thinking, but he's trying to interpret what he thinks she would be thinking.
I can see that perspective, because, like, it's a movie, it starts and ends with Turner, and it's like, it's his story more than her story.
Yeah.
And there's something so enigmatic about her, like when they're driving in the car and she's talking, and like, how much can you get past not even just the language, but like just what's going on inside another person's head? What do they feel? Like, you know, we've probably all been in situations where we care more about somebody else than they care about us, or vice versa. I don't know.
And one thing about the editing in the car scene, that they keep an extreme shot of like her adjusting her skirt. And like him looking, and it's like, oh yeah, and you know, it's just like every guy, you know, can relate to like that feeling.
It's not really focused on what she's saying.
I was going to say that that's just a male gaze perspective that every man is familiar with. It's just like, zone out. No, I am listening. Zone out. Same thing at the bar. It's like he has that very short fantasy about that completely different woman, and of course, you know, it doesn't work out.
Yeah,
with
she's
her,
so she's like a blonde bombshell. And then you get, like, you know, the woman that we follow.
And it's like the super fast fantasy that every man has. Oh, look at that attractive woman. Anyways, I'm going back to what I was doing. Like,
well, like, and the image he constructs for himself, like with the sunglasses, and then like of course those fall off and break, and that's kind of like the peeling back of the veneer of the cool, I always thought.
Oh, yeah.
And like, it's sort of fun. Like Melvin Van Peebles, his later films, it's almost like. Like, when you get to Sweetback, I always think it's like, oh, the sunglasses never come off. Like, it's all about that kind of image and the sort of, like, the coolness of it, I guess you could say. You know, and that's kind of part of that statement. But, like, Story of a Three-Day Pass, I think that's maybe a reason why I prefer it as a film.
Yeah. I had one more thing to get. I can't remember. Anyway, so, Watermelon Man, I think, is on Amazon Video. I have the DVD, because I personally like that one a little more than Story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not because I hate French New Wave, although some people think I do. I don't understand French New Wave. I should probably, like, if there's a podcast on it, let me know. I want to understand it more. And maybe it's because, maybe I don't like Godard. Maybe that might be it.
That's totally understood. Godard is very unlikable sometimes, most of the time. And have you seen anything by Truffaut?
Not yet. I've been on the verge of watching the Piano Player one for a while.
Shoot the Piano Player. Okay, Nicole Berger's in that. She's like one of the main characters.
And there's some other Truffaut ones. There are other French New Wave people that I really have no clue who they are. Is Jacques Demy considered French New Wave?
I don't know. Like, he's kind of his own thing, like doing musicals. I guess.
I mean, he gets his biggest association
was just being like married to Agnes Varda. Yeah. So
also he's because kind of like he's taking his influences from early American films, the way that people say that other people are influenced. But yeah, it does feel super different.
Yeah. And Jacques Tati doesn't count, but Jacques Tati was...
Oh, no, he's the king of French New Wave. That's what I heard.
Oh, then I like French New Wave, then. He's the greatest comedy director of all time, in my opinion. Watermelon Man is, streaming sometimes. There's DVD.
They're both available on Amazon if you have the subscription for $3.99 to Brown Sugar.
Yeah, and 3-day pass.
I think the DVD's out of print now.
There's some real cheap ones that I've been tempted to buy, but
the Xenon Pictures one.
Yeah,
I keep hoping for that Blu-ray. It's gonna come someday.
Like, yeah, we touched on it earlier, but the image doesn't look too good on it. It looks. No. It really needs an update at some point.
Yeah.
And Melvin is 87. He's like, he's born in the early 30s.
He just had his birthday. He's up there. He's basically retired now. Like, he still does interviews every once in a while and kind of talks about, you know, making films and writing and doing music and his many, many careers and stuff. But I think he's pretty much retired now.
Yeah, so I hope he lives to see his movies get a new life. And I don't know. He's important, but like,
well, again, but
I don't know, like, if he's like really that talked about right now, because I feel like he's been forgotten a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, people can go and check out the Sweet Sweetback Spada song Blu-ray that's out now, the Vinegar Syndrome one. I feel like he did kind of have like a little bit of resurgence around. Like, whenever the time Badass came out, like, maybe early 2000s, kind of got a lot of people to go back and check it out again. I always think, it's funny. So, of course, his son, Mario Van Peebles, is also a director, but, like, his style's so different, actually, than his father's. Like, Melvin Van Peebles, that kind of, like, French New Wavy, like, I'm gonna ignore all the rules and break everything. And, like, Mario Van Peebles, I always think, like, his directorial style's, like, very kind of... Not like classic Hollywood, but very sort of more conventional. If you watch stuff like Posse or New Jack City. But to me, it's always funny watching Badass. Or maybe not funny, but like interesting the way it's filtered through the son's perspective. Like, the most recent time I watched it, I was thinking, it looked almost like Mario and Peoples was thinking, like, oh, I'm going to play my dad. I better hit the gym and get, like, bulky. And then you go back and watch, like, Sweet Sweet Beck's Badass Dog, and, like, he's not G.I. Joe. He's, like, skinny, intense-looking guy in that film. And, like, there's a couple scenes in Badass where I always think it's funny to see, like, yeah, that's clearly, like, a son's idea of what their father's like. And to the point where I'm not even sure how much of that Mario Van Peebles is aware of. Like, he's just kind of doing it. But that's a pretty good film, too, if you want to check it out. Like, the Badass movie starts with Melvin Van Peebles actually finishing up work on Watermelon Man.
Oh, okay.
And gets into him sort of burning his bridges and going off to make Sweetback. But, yeah, so, I guess we're pretty much wrapped up now.
Yeah.
But,
you were recently on my favorite podcast, The Production Booth. During my favorite time of the year, podcasting wise, Czech Timber, talking about the ear.
Yeah, people can listen to that. It's also that conversation's on the Blu-ray for the ear, so you can listen to me as an audio commentary. Hopefully, people enjoy that. I think it's a good conversation.
Yeah, I've seen the ear and I liked it, but there's a whole layer of it that I had no idea about. And then listening to episodes, like, okay, I have a new appreciation of this movie.
It's a good one to kind of like dig into, and you can pull a lot out of. But thank you for having me on this show, and I'm glad I could finally make an appearance. And I don't know how coherent I was, but maybe it's appropriate considering the topics we sort of jumped through.
Yeah.
And if anyone wants to follow me, the best place is on Twitter at Movie Kessler, and you can listen to a lot more of me at flixwise.com. I'm on the Flixwise Canada podcast.
Yeah, I think I was one of the recent ones. Screaming Man, Sex Okra.
And the Sex Okra and Salted Butter.
Yeah. And I have some ideas for upcoming ones, but I will measure to do those later.
Well, I can say there's upcoming ones on Fantomas, the silent serial, and another one, maybe I'll just tease it, that's related to a famous animator.
No, I have an idea, but you could throw a curveball at me.
You probably do.
Okay. Yeah. But I have some ideas for my next appearance on Flixwise Canada. I just have to figure out which idea I want to pick. But, yeah.
Okay, sounds good.
Joel, what's up with you?
I don't know. My other podcast is kind of on a break anyways, because we can't get our schedules to get together. But, I mean, there's 186 previous episodes of Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space. If you like science fiction and fantasy movies, the last episode we did was the one we did with Spencer.
Really?
Matador.
Mm-hmm. Who directed Matador?
Melvin Van Peebles.
Oh,
I thought it was Pedro Almodóvar. Yeah, it's about people who like fucking and killing and fucking and killing at the same time. And Antonio Banderas has psychic powers. The end.
It's just so relatable.
Yes, it's as relatable as the story of a 3-day pass. But even more so, because I personally love stabbing. No, but something I don't think I've ever mentioned on the podcast before. If you want to communicate with me for some weird reason, I am on Twitter at a separate account on at JDT Movies. You can tell me how wrong I was about anything you'd so desire, if you wish.
Okay. Next month is Halloween month, so there will be a Candyman episode with Megan Sunday, and I have to buy Candyman pretty soon because it's not streaming anywhere, last I checked.
The Shout Factory Blu-ray is really nice. It's got the director's cut and the original theatrical cut, and it's good. It's really, really good.
Yeah, you should buy it anyways. Come on.
I will have to buy it probably to watch it. And the normal episode will be, what is it? 25th Hour with Darren Husted. And the other episode will be Chicago with hopeful guest Alexandra what's her name? Film and Vinyl. That's her site. What's her, Alexandra Daniel?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's a really good writer. I keep kind of hoping I can like get her on FlixWise someday, but I'll see.
She picked Chicago, which Joel isn't happy about for some reason. But we'll get to that when we get to that. So, and maybe a Kill by Kill crossover on Tales from the Hood. So at least one Halloween episode, possibly two.
I'll just drive to Patrick's house and like force him to be on a microphone if I have to, you know.
Okay.
At gunpoint. That's a lot to look forward to.
That's it for October, and then we got a couple, and maybe the Dolomite movie whenever that comes out. We'll get to that.
Maybe Harriet.
Some of the reviews are discouraging. I don't know what I gotta see it first.
Yeah. I heard it's kind of like a. It feels like a made-for-TV movie, kind of, which is disappointing. Like,
yeah, so after I see Harriet, then I'll determine whether I want to talk about it. So yeah, that's.
I just watched Eve's Bayou. Like the director's cut was at the Lightbox recently, so I saw that, and the director was there in attendance, and
Casey Lemons,
like that's awesome. She talked about the film and kind of how the director's cut changed for the theatrical. But that was a really great experience. And then kind of like off of that, hearing that Harriet might not be that great is kind of disappointing, but I'll see. I'll have to see it for myself. You know, sometimes you don't know.
Yeah.
Speaking of Candyman.
Oh yeah.
She's in Candyman. She's in all the good stuff. She was in like Silence of the Lambs.
Upcoming episode with the guest from Eve's Bayou, Bo North.
Oh, cool.
So I feel like Bo North picked that because of Casey, also Hannibal Lecter, because I know she loves Hannibal Lecter shit. So yeah, that's it for this episode. We'll catch you guys for maybe the Jackie Brown episode. I haven't edited it yet, so that will come up. That will be dropping at some point. And yeah, so thank you, Martin, and see you guys next
time.
Thank
you.
Bye-bye.
Cool. So I'm going to hit stop.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.